Hello, everyone. Welcome to a very special episode of Uncanny Treks. And this week, we turn our attention to the very short Walt Simonson run on Fantastic Four. This is a late 80s, early 90s run. It takes up three trades. Coincidentally, we'll do it in three issues, three episodes. I am Bob in Cascadia. That is Matt in the Southland. Matt, how are you doing tonight?
Doing great, Bob, man. I've read some great Fantastic Four. I've read Hickman's run, read Wade's run. Now we're hitting Walt Simonson, who you told me is great stuff. I've just finished his first volume. It's pretty good.
Yeah, I think the first story, the Acts of Vengeance story, which, you know, we'll talk about here in a minute, I think it's mid, honestly. There's some good stuff about it and then some not so great stuff about it. But then the five-part Into the Time Stream, I love that. It's some all-time great FF comics. So, yeah, there's some other very interesting stuff that you might like more coming, but I do think the Into the Time Stream five-parter is a high point in some ways.
Definitely. The whole concept of the time stream stuff is crazy, so we'll get into it as we go through the issues. But, yeah, overall great. Enjoyed reading it.
Good, good. I'm glad it keeps the momentum from Hickman and Wade. So I know when I was a kid, I didn't really read much by Walt Simonson. I didn't get into him until a few years ago. Do you remember having read much by Walt Simonson?
As a child, no, but I did read something not too long ago where he did the artwork. He was the artist for Frank Miller's RoboCop versus Terminator series that came out in like 92.
Which is really good.
Yeah, it is.
I also read it maybe 5-10 years ago, and I was very impressed. I was also just amazed that it was Frank Miller and Walter Simonson on RoboCop versus Terminator.
Frank Miller does a great job with RoboCop. I've always liked Frank Miller and RoboCop go hand in hand.
That's a good pull. That's even something we should think about doing for the podcast at some point, is RoboCop versus Terminator. Then I was going to ask, Matt, do you remember a series? It was a very short series of backups from Detective Comics in the 70s. And I had a thin little trade of it when we were in high school or college. It was called Manhunter. It was a gold cover.
Oh, yes, I do remember reading. Yes, I remember that.
Simonson was the artist on that. That was one of his first gigs in the mid-70s. And then Archie Goodwin, the famous writer and editor, was the writer. Did you read any of the early X-Factor when it's the original five?
No, but I've learned more about that since going back and rereading X-Men. I have read some of those issues as an adult.
Okay, yeah. So Simonson's not writing that stuff. It's his wife, Louise, or Wheezy, who's writing. And she doesn't start it. A different writer and artist start the series. But pretty early on, Louise Simonson comes on as the writer. And I think a little later on, Walt comes on as the artist, and I believe he's coming off his big run on Thor from the 80s, which is one of the all-time great Marvel 80s comics, along with Frank Miller Daredevil. I didn't read Walt Simonson Thor until a couple of years ago, but it's very much worth a read. If you ever want to read the great Thor run, that's the 80s Walt Simonson Thor run.
I wonder how many like husband-wife comic book writer-artist teams there are like that.
There's Amanda Connor and Jimmy Palmiotti. For a while, there was Brian Azzarello and Jill Thompson, although they got divorced at some point, I believe. There's David and Maria Lapham. There's a couple others that are not coming to mind. Oh, Matt Fraction and Kelly Sue DeConnick, although they haven't collaborated on comics as much. I think they've maybe collaborated on some screenplay stuff.
I'd love to know if that creative process is easier or more difficult for these people.
I could see having to hive off. You have to have your professional collaboration, then running the household, then your romantic side, and having at least three different facets to the relationship could be really complicated, right?
Yeah, I can draw a wedge between people.
For sure. Matt, I did want to make one other joke about Walt Simonson before we start this. So, in my mind, Walt Simonson starts this Fantastic Four run right after the John Byrne run. That's not true. There's actually a fair number of issues in between them. But in my mind, I always think of the Walt Simonson run coming right after the John Byrne run. I hate the John Byrne run. I've said this on the air before. And so I like that at Marvel in the late 80s, Walt Simonson takes over Fantastic Four after John Byrne, takes over the big Jack Kirby project for John Byrne. To me, makes John Byrne look like a chump. Makes John Byrne's run look so weak. And then do you know what happens at DC in the mid-90s, Matt? John Byrne does a really crappy New God series. It sucks. It's boring. No one likes it. Your boy Bob doesn't like it. You know what happens? John Byrne leaves. Walt Simonson comes in. He starts the Orion series in the mid-90s, late 90s at DC. It's great. It's amazing. It's on a Jack Kirby project. It makes John Byrne look like a chump. I like that. I like that. I like that Walt Simonson makes John Byrne look like a chump, because John Byrne is a chump.
Yeah. Bob does not like John.
I actually do like some John Byrne comics. I like his Superman comics. I like his art on X-Men. I just also think he's a chump.
There you go. Man, Walt Simonson always just swoops in and fixes things. What would have happened if Walt Simonson would have come in and redone Man of Steel, Bob? Would have picked up after Superman?
I like what Jerry Ordway did after John Byrne on Superman, but I can't deny that it would have been better if it had been Walt Simonson. No offense to Jerry Ordway. Love Jerry Ordway. But it would have been better if it had been Walt Simonson.
And we have no ideas or anything that would have even taken place. Bob just knows it. He just knows it would have been better.
I've got strong empirical evidence. I saw what Walt Simonson did on Orion. I saw what Walt Simonson did on Fantastic Four.
All right, Bob, let's talk about what's going on here in Fantastic Four.
All right, so we're going to talk about the two arcs in this first trade. That's the Fantastic Four Visionaries by Walter Simonson, Volume 1 trade. So we'll just talk about the two arcs together, separately and all together, instead of going into individual issues. So the first arc is issues number 334 to 336 of Fantastic Four. This is 89, maybe into 90. It's called Acts of Vengeance. It's a tie-in to the Marvel Acts of Vengeance event. It's a three-parter. Matt, do you remember the Acts of Vengeance event from the late 80s? I know, obviously, we were too young to actually be reading the Acts of Vengeance, but I think we both had a couple of like back issues that tied into this event when we were kids.
I vaguely remember it.
The idea was like the Marvel villains all got together and they switched antagonist. And so you got a lot of interesting payoffs. Here you get the Fantastic Four versus a bunch of jobbers is the premise of the Acts of Vengeance tie-in. But in Punisher, it's Punisher fights Dr. Doom. In Daredevil, it's Daredevil fights Ultron, which sounds stupid, but it's a really good comic. And in Doctor Strange, he fights Hobgoblin, who's possessed by a demon. Then this was one I hadn't read. I was just looking online to see what the other absurd Acts of Vengeance crossovers were. And do you know Typhoid Mary from Daredevil?
Oh, yeah.
She fights the Power Pack.
That's creepy.
Have you seen the famous page that gets published online a lot where Magneto buries Red Skull in a hole? Magneto is Jewish and Romani, and Red Skull is a Nazi. Yeah. So that's from the Acts of Vengeance tie-in in Captain America that Magneto buries Red Skull.
I was trying to figure out why they were together in the same comic. They just said, hey, we'll stick all the villains from one set of... We'll stick all this guy's villains with this character and just see how they would handle the situation. Which, I mean, it's not a bad idea. It's fun. It was easier to do that with Marvel, too, because I think DC, I feel like they share a lot of the same antagonists at times.
Although you definitely do have signature antagonists. On the one hand, Marvel's always been a shared universe. But on the other hand, this is the late 80s where they're really, really waking up to using the shared universe in a crossover way. So we have Rich Buckler does the first two artists of the Acts of Vengeance arc. And he was a signature Fantastic Four artist in the 70s. I think this is his last work on Fantastic Four, these two issues. And I just would say I most fondly like his work from the late 70s, where he did a few issues for Don McGregor's Black Panther run. That's really good. That's Rich Buckler. And then the third issue in this Acts of Vengeance tie-in, that's by Ron Lim, who did a lot of the drawing of the original Infinity Gauntlet trilogy a couple years after this.
This artwork, too, when I think of early 90s, it sticks out. It's so different compared to what I think of. I always think of the X-Men stuff that Jim Lee did in the early 90s.
On Punisher while this is going on.
This is the kind of style that carried over from the 80s, but we haven't hit that like extreme 90s stuff yet.
You can see where the 90s is coming.
Exactly, right? For sure. Especially with the technology and everything, those pieces involved with it. It's very interesting. All right, so Bob, let's talk about what goes on in this comic. So the summary of this first arc we've got, while speaking at a congressional hearing on the Superhuman Registration Act, the Fantastic Four are attacked by random supervillains.
A random bunch of jobbers, Matt. A random bunch of jobbers. Did you immediately clock the similarity of this to Civil War?
Oh, yeah. It like stuck out like a sore thumb. To me, some of these things, they just go back to the same well later on. You see a lot of the same things.
I don't care enough to actually go back and see, but I think Mark Miller may have literally picked up lines of dialogue from this comic for the Civil War crossover 15 years later. I might be wrong about that, but some of the arguments about who the political coalition is supporting and opposing the Superhuman Registration Act. I feel like that's almost said word for word in Civil War in 2005.
All they did was just take this concept later on in 2005, 2006 and make it more serious or see it all the way through, as opposed to this where they just cut it off with the way Reed gets around this at the end.
What it is very interesting seeing the idea used as fodder for a three-part comedy arc versus seeing it used as fodder for, wasn't Civil War 8 issues, so an 8-issue universe-shaking crossover.
Right. Just completely different.
Yeah, very different modes of telling what's essentially the same story. So, Matt, we have a little bit of a non-standard status quo for the Fantastic Four at the start of this. I guess most notably, we have She-Thing. Had you ever heard of She-Thing? And, you know, she shouldn't be confused with Miss Thing from Matt Fraction's Future Foundation.
No, Bob. It's so jarring because they call her Miss Marvel.
Which I think both before and after this for different periods. At this point, Carol Danvers was no longer Miss Marvel. Maybe she was binary after the Brood saga.
This is Sharon Ventura.
I don't know much about her either before she becomes She-Thing and after She-Thing. I think she is a Miss Marvel for a while, but I don't know anything about her powers or her origin or her personality either.
But yes, Ben Grimm is still around. He's just in human form. And he wears the same trench coat that Big Thing that he wears when he's the Rock Thing. So not much has changed.
That trench coat, it's a good fashion statement. It's a good fashion statement. And at some point around this run, when Ben Grimm is in human form, Reed has built a Thing suit for him. And that Thing suit is the thing that Miss Thing in Matt Fraction's Future Foundation is using. It's the shell that gives him strength that's somewhat comparable to his strength as the Thing.
And he literally looks like the Thing, though, when he's wearing it. It's not Iron Man'd up or anything.
But sometimes they'll do the thing where he doesn't have the helmet on. And so you'll have Ben's human head or you'll have Miss Thing's human head poking out of the Rock Nexus. Does that make sense?
Yeah, but thankfully, when this appears in Fantastic Four First Steps, it'll just be that face thing that disappears, like the mask that goes up. Like Iron Man.
That's awful. This makes me really sad and like really want to do some self-harm. But let's turn to a positive thing, which is, Matt, Ben Grimm, like you, loves Batman 1989.
You think Batman has ever said anything in one of his comic books about the Fantastic Four movies?
My first instinct here was to say, of course, Batman would never go to a Fantastic Four movie. But upon further reflection, I was, well, there are an awful lot of comics where the Robins drag Bruce out to a movie. So I could see Damian dragging him to an FF movie, and I can see him not enjoying it on one level, but enjoying being with his son on another.
Yeah, probably saw Rise of the Silver Surfer. I would hope Damian wouldn't have drug him to like the 2015, 2016 one, whatever that movie was.
Yeah, I think Damian was still too much in villain mode back then, and so maybe wouldn't have been interested, thankfully.
Good. Good for Damian.
Speaking of doing creepy things to appease your son, Matt, did you notice Reed in dinosaur form to play with Franklin on page 15? And were you as horrified by it as I was?
Yeah, I just tried to ignore it and pretend it didn't happen because I didn't think that Mr. Fantastic could do that. That doesn't seem like a power he should have. It's horrifying and not his common switcheroo thing he does where he stretches. And it's more Plastic Man-like, in my opinion.
That's true. And it's clearly meant to be cute. And it just doesn't
horrifying.
Come off. Yeah, and it's just horrifying. And then, Matt, what was your favorite page or your favorite panel?
Well, my favorite panels is actually, it's on page 33. The Fantastic Four is before Congress talking about this Registration Act. And there's, this guy's watching C-SPAN. And he's like, boring. I thought C-SPAN was going to pay off for once by showing the Fantastic Four. But forget this. I want to see something with a little content. And he switches to Wheel of Fortune. And to me, that's just so weird because even like that joke still rings today. You can still switch and watch Wheel of Fortune and C-SPAN is still boring. No one watches it. And what's funny is C-SPAN came out in the late 70s. So within 10 years, it was complete garbage. No one wants to watch that.
I don't know. Now you're making me defensive on behalf of C-SPAN. There's so much garbage channels on cable. C-SPAN's ratings really much worse than...
They must have been awful. They must have been awful even back then, Bob. This is boring, even with the Fantastic Four on it.
think there's a maybe more layers to that joke than you're giving it credit for, because it's not like Wheel of Fortune is riveting television.
It's not, but Wheel of Fortune is still on the air today.
The joke is not just about C-SPAN. The joke is also about the media consumer who's actually willing to put up with a lot of boredom. He just has a very restricted idea of what boredom he will put up with and what boredom he won't put up with, if that makes sense.
Right. He'd much rather watch Wheel of Fortune than watch politics on C-SPAN. But what he doesn't know, Bob, is there's about to be some superheroes, some bad supervillains busting up in this congressional hearing. One of them including Apocalypse, Bob, who doesn't stop by. He just flies over. What was the deal with that? Why? Why did Apocalypse show up? X-Men's Apocalypse, folks.
Well, he's not X-Men's Apocalypse yet. He's just X-Factor's Apocalypse.
X-Factor's.
This is happening at the same time that Walt Simonson and his wife are on X-Factor, and there's a big story of Apocalypse attacking, I think, New York, although here it's Washington. They're in Washington. And so it's tying into what Simon, and that's also, I think, why Simonson does the art on the next arc, but he doesn't do the arc on this arc because he's still doing the art for the big Apocalypse climax on X-Factor.
That explains a lot, Bob, because, yeah, he was just trying to impress his wife and say, hey, we can make these crossover.
That's actually something Simonson does a lot, because his early days on X-Factor coincided with his later days on Thor. And so he does a lot of little small crossovers between his Thor run and his run on X-Factor, which is just something Simonson seems to do a lot when he is on two books at the same time.
So Apocalypse just flies over, but we get all these other villains, Bob. We get a whole lot of these D-list guys.
Matt, who is your favorite among the D-listers?
My favorite D-lister has to be the Quill. He's like a porcupine dude.
I think we're both just outing ourselves as furries, Matt, because mine's the eel.
Most of them had some sort of theme going. You had Shocker.
I like that, not to criticize, but you picked the one Spider-Man villain who doesn't have an animal gimmick.
There was one that was an orca.
That's a Batman villain. There's a Spider-Man whale villain, too.
Yeah, hold up. You had the Wrecking Crew. We get to see a couple of these characters on page 62. And you've got Whirlwind, who I'm familiar with from the video game of the Avengers. He was the first bad guy you had to fight, so I always thought he was a bigger thing, but apparently he wasn't.
He also in the 90s Iron Man cartoon.
Yeah, they had an action figure of him. They also have Stilt Man.
You know what a Whirlwind's signature thing is to me now?
No, what does he do?
He stalks the Wasp.
Oh, well, that's creepy. Here he just spins around a lot. You've got Owl, who just looks like Evil Beast.
It's a little funny that they're putting the Owl in as a jobber. Owl's still a fairly, like, major villain in Daredevil and Spider-Man.
Yeah, but over in the corner, you've got this character called Orca the Killer Whale, who has teeth on its face and a whale-colored body, but you don't get to see her in action. I don't know if that's a totally different character from the one we see in Batman.
Yeah, I incorrectly accused you of just pulling in your favorite Batman jobber into this conversation. Shall we move on to the second and final arc here, Into the Time Stream, which is issues 337 to 341?
Sure. So as we continue on in our journey with the Fantastic Four, we discover that a renegade celestial is creating a weapon deep inside a 15-year-long time bubble. Sounds crazy.
Yeah, and we do get some comic book nonsense in this issue that I just love. Specifically, I believe Reed's Radical Cube. It's hard for me to remember, but I believe it is a device that we have seen several times before in Fantastic Four comics. But instead of just going with the Radical Cube, Reed has expanded it, and now it's a radical dodecahedron, which I just think is hilarious.
Way better. More sides.
Yes, so many more sides, Matt. And then, did you know who the kids they leave Franklin with are while the Fantastic Four goes into the time stream?
Of course, Bob. They're the Power Pack.
They just fought Typhoid Mary, Matt. Scarred by that experience at all.
Franklin was hanging out with them then, too.
He was a member of the team.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I will say the Citizen Kane reference of Reed naming his time sled Rosebud, I think that's really funny. It's a time-traveling sled named Rosebud. That's so funny to me. Props to Simonson for that joke.
It is. And I want to give Reed just some here, Bob, because when he puts together vehicles, this sled, it's got nothing covering it. It's just a bunch of seats.
On the one hand, Matt, I agree with you. Reed has no sense of vehicular design. But on the other hand, you do have to admit the man has a constant aesthetic vision. I'm not saying it's good, but the time sled, the fantastic car, the flying motorcycles, it's all clearly the product of the same mind.
Yeah, he doesn't take the time to paint any of it.
No, he's all about that off-white. Mm-hmm. Loves that off-white. It looks good with their blue uniforms. Go for it. And then we also find in the early days of this arc, Matt, that Johnny and Alicia are dating. Does that seem like entirely wrong to you?
So wrong. That's just a weird, that's got to be some weird 90s thing they were trying to do to like spice things up on the Fantastic Four. That's
yeah,
so lame.
They do.
Thank God.
Do you know what the retcon is?
I don't care, but whatever it is.
It turns out it's a Skrull impersonator.
Perfect.
All right. And we get a lot of guest spots in this arc, Matt. We get guest spots from Thor, from the Celestials, from Iron Man. But we get one guest spot that I just can't explain to you. I knew in my bones that you were going to ask me about who Death's Head is. And I don't know who Death's Head is, Matt. I can't explain Death's Head to you.
He's like General Grievous.
General Grievous 20 years before General Grievous.
And he's got a motorcycle that flies, and it's got a Gatling gun on it.
The Space Bounty Hunter, and he was produced by Marvel UK. Maybe he was influential on Lobo, now that I think about it. Although, again, I've not read Death's Head comics and don't understand him at all.
Well, he goes off on one of the Kang guys, so, I mean, he can't be that bad. He just rips the Kang dude's face off.
I can't remember, Matt. Have you watched Loki Season 2?
I've watched the first season in its entirety. I did not even attempt to watch the second season. But the TVA is a huge piece of Loki Season 1. And then they bring the TVA up in here, and I'm like, oh, this stuff's been around for a long time.
I think Simonson created the Temporal Variance Authority, or the TVA, in his Thor run. So this end of the time stream way is not only, we saw how Simonson tied the first arc into his run, his concurrent run on X-Factor with his wife, but he's also calling back several things from his Thor run in the Into the Time Stream arc.
Yeah, this run is very heavy on Thor, so if you don't like Thor the way that Simonson writes him, you're not going to enjoy this.
I'm overreading this, but I just want to say, if you don't like Thor the way Simonson writes him, you don't like Thor.
There you go. That should be one of our podcast clips right there, Bob.
Yeah.
If you don't like Simonson Thor, you just don't like Thor. Oh.
That's true. The other thing I really wanted to underline here is one of my favorite things about this arc is just Walt Simonson's caption game is so good. The end of issue 2, he has a caption, "We're not even sure if we're going to publish a next issue. It may be 22 all blank pages, Matt." He was predicting 0 hour.
He was.
5 years before 0 hour. It's amazing.
Technically, he did 0 hour like before 0 hour with that one page.
Knew the power
of a white panel with just the sled. There's also a page within this, guys, where you just see the word bubbles when time has come to a standstill or something.
And then to Matt's issue about we're having a lot of non-FF Marvel characters in this, the cover of issue number 3 really speaks to Matt's concern of, it's Thor versus Gladiator.
Yeah.
Hey, whose book is this anyway?
Yeah, you don't know what's going on there, but some really cool appearances, though. Like you just said, Gladiator shows up, but it's meant to be this alternate version of Gladiator. I think, like, they're in a different time. Well, my understanding is there's so many different time shifts here that we don't really know which time they're in.
I think that's
yeah. You have to understand when you read these comics, it's cosmic. It's crazy cosmic type stuff. Literally, you're going to the center of this time bubble, and Galactus ends up there, and he's siphoning energy into himself. And in order to destroy the weapon that's apparently being built, they go to the Shi'ar Empire and gather all these bombs. And there's a whole scene where they spend 2 or 3 days just loading up these ships with bombs to send at Galactus. And it's there where we meet Gladiator, and he's doing his whole spiel. But he figures out something rather quickly that the rest of the FF don't, Bob, and that Johnny has been possessed. It wasn't as clear to me as it should have been about Johnny being possessed. It took me a minute to figure out what was going on.
I was going to say, just a general contrast to what you're saying, one of the things I appreciate about the cosmic stakes of this comic is that I think Simonson's very good at rendering it in a strong visual language. So on the one hand, there is this complicated stuff with alternate universes, alternate timelines, people being possessed, replaced. But on the other hand, he just gives you lots of big, creative, visually interesting images to follow along. And so you don't have to worry about the details that much and can just be drawn along by the power of his artwork.
Well, I do have a question, Bob, about Celestials. How many Celestials are buried on Earth, and do they just show up then the Fantastic Four need them?
That's a that's not true. Sometimes they show up when the Avengers need them.
Or the X-Men.
Not just
X-Men, too.
And there's that. Well, that. So, in fairness, that one's not Barry. That one's just standing in San Francisco.
Yeah. These things are like, they're supposed to be these ancient things. They're just there. They're all over the place.
The one in San Francisco Park wasn't always there. They didn't build San Francisco Park around it.
The more I'm exposed to the Celestials, Bob, the less, like, intriguing they are to me. And I feel like Fantastic Four really likes to go back to the Celestials.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, the original Kirby Eternal series from the late 70s is pretty good. It doesn't make me have affection for the Celestials, but I don't resent the Celestials in the way I resent Death's Head when they show up and I have to try to understand them.
Yeah, at least I can understand the Celestials, whereas with DC, I cannot understand the Monitors.
Well, I would say that's because the Celestials were created by one of the greatest writers and artists to ever do it, Jack Kirby. And so they're inherently interesting. And also they're space gods. It makes sense. I would say the problem with the Monitor is that it was imagined by Marv Wolfman when he was 5. And then when they gave him the keys to Crisis on Infinite Earths, he was like, oh, what if I use this character I created when I was 5 and made it the most important thing in the DC universe? That's dumb. You shouldn't do that.
All right, so let's talk favorite panels in this last piece here, bub.
Yeah, my favorite panel is relatively late. It's on 183 in the trade, and it's right before your favorite panel, which you sort of referenced earlier. And so it's the time bubble is contracting everything in and of itself, coming out of Galactus's hand. And then we have the FF on Rosebud fleeing the time bubble. And you have Reed giving the amazing dialogue, existentialators at 110%, which just really makes me laugh.
Well, Bob, on the next page is my favorite. It's 184, and you've got the blank page. Now, was this a 2-page spread in the original issues?
It was, yeah.
So he had a completely white page. Wow. Well, anyway, you get a white page, and on the other page, you have the time slid, and Ben saying, we ain't gonna make it. The big nothing's catching up to us. And then Reed says, perimeter insertion countdown, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, and then you switch pages.
Really great use of white space and a really good use of the background colors, because it's interesting because on 184, it's all white except for the characters. But then on 185, you go back to this really good coloring job of like the red and the purple kind of vortex background. Excellent work.
All right, Bob. All right. So what's next in store for us?
We'll do Fantastic Four by Walt Simonson, Visionaries, Volume 2. I forget which number of issues it actually is, but it's that trade. We'll do that trade next. And I look forward to talking with you about it, Matt. That'll be on Uncanny Treks. I'm Bob in Cascadia. That's Matt in the Southland. Have a good night, everybody.
Thanks for listening.